5:05 was Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Iraqi security forces launched an operation Monday to retake the city of Fallujah from Islamic State extremists. Led by the counterterrorism service, Iraqi forces backed by airstrikes entered the city before dawn to engage IS defenders who first occupied the city 2.5 years ago. Iraqi Brigadier General Ali al-Hamdani said there is excellent coordination between the army and Shia militia units taking part in the operation. He said enemy defense strongholds have been broken, Sharia courts destroyed, and command and control centers neutralized. As the battle raged, there are concerns over the plight of civilians trapped inside, along with the threat posed by booby traps, roadside bombs, and suicide attackers. Former Chadian dictator Issa Nabre has been found guilty of atrocities committed during his 8-year rule and sentenced to life in prison. A special tribunal in Senegal issued the verdict Monday, convicting Nabre of war crimes, crimes against humanity, and torture. Specific crimes included what the court called the massive and systematic practice of summary execution. Suleiman Gwengweng, a rights activist and torture victim, proclaimed himself satisfied. He said it hurts. Many of his colleagues died along the way. Still, he added, it is a happy moment. Human Rights Watch, which worked closely with victims of Abre to bring him to trial, said the verdict sends a message that the days when tyrants would brutalize their people, pillage their treasury, and escape abroad to a life of luxury are coming to an end. Abre fled to Senegal after being overthrown by Idriss Deby. This is VOA News. The South Korean Defense Ministry says the North Korean effort to test fire a ballistic missile appears to have failed. It says the missile test, in violation of UN Security Council resolutions, took place in the early hours of Tuesday near the eastern coastal city Wonsan. The ministry didn't indicate what type of missile, but the Yonhap News Agency said it was a medium-range Musudon missile, which the North Koreans have tried 3 times before but failed to launch. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, as he swore in his new defense minister, held out the prospect Monday of reviving the Moabit Peace Initiative with the Palestinians.
I take this opportunity to make clear that I remain committed to making peace with the Palestinians and with all our neighbors. The Arab Peace Initiative includes positive elements that can help revive constructive negotiations with the Palestinians.
Mr. Netanyahu said his government is prepared to negotiate with Arab states revisions to a 2002 Arab Peace Initiative to reflect what he called the dramatic changes on the ground. New Defense Chief Avigdor Lieberman of the right-of-center Yisrael Beiteinu party said he's committed to 2 states for 2 peoples. Mr. Lieberman's party widens the government's majority in the Israeli parliament, or Knesset. Taliban militants in Afghanistan intensified attacks in their southern stronghold of Helmand province, killing at least 12 policemen Monday, reportedly more than 30 on Sunday. Helmand is the largest province in Afghanistan and is a poppy-producing region. Egyptian authorities have taken into custody the head of the country's journalist union, along with 2 associates, for spreading false news and harboring fugitives. The trial is expected to get underway Saturday. They've been released after being questioned pending the trial. They face prison time if convicted. Amnesty International denounced the legal action, calling it a dangerous escalation, part of the government's draconian crackdown on freedom of expression. Davao City Mayor Rodrigo Duterte was officially proclaimed president-elect of the Philippines by the Congress Monday, with Congresswoman Leni Robredo as his vice president-elect. Mr. Duterte skipped the ceremony Monday, remaining in Davao City, where he has resided since his May 9 electoral victory. President Obama commemorated the nation's war dead Monday on Memorial Day in remarks at Arlington National Cemetery outside Washington, calling on Americans to help the families of the fallen. He called on the living to fill the silence of those who died serving their country.
For us, the living, those of us who still have a voice, it is our responsibility, our obligation, to fill that silence with our love and our support and our gratitude, and not just with words, but with our actions.
Americans have set aside the last Monday of each May to observe Memorial Day, once known as Decoration Day in the 19th century, following the country's bloody civil war. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 31st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Former Ivory Coast First Lady Simone Gbagbo goes on trial today for crimes against humanity.
Mrs. Gbagbo is not guilty of whatever crime she's being charged with. This is why I say it is nothing but harassment, pure harassment.
Boubacar Kone is interim spokesman for the Ivorian Popular Front Party of former President Laurent Gbagbo. Former Chadian President Issa Habre has been found guilty of crimes against humanity and sentenced to life in prison. And Ugandan police have again canceled the swearing-in ceremony of the Lord Mayor of Kampala City.
What possible explanation do they have to keep on postponing the swearing-in ceremony for the leadership of the capital city, the gateway to the country? Certainly they are up to a mischief. They are up to something sinister.
Erias Lukwago is the Lord Mayor of Kampala City. An image has been shown to journalists said to be that of missing Zimbabwe political activist Itai Zamora. China blocks a UN resolution to limit lead in paint and will examine the growth of Nigeria's film industry. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. In Ivory Coast, the wife of former President Laurent Gbagbo goes on trial today, Tuesday. Simone Gbagbo, also known as the Iron Lady, is accused of crimes against humanity for her alleged role in the country's 2010 post-election violence that killed more than 3,000 people. Her husband and former President Laurent Gbagbo and his former youth minister, Charles Blay Goudé, are currently on trial at the International Criminal Court, also for their alleged roles in the 2010 post-election violence. Boubacar Kone, interim spokesman of the Ivorian Popular Front Party, says Mrs. Gbagbo is not guilty of any crime and that the case against her is a political and judicial harassment.
Obviously, this is seen as a total harassment. It is both political and judiciary harassment. Since Mr. Gbagbo was being tried in The Hague, his wife is also harassed here, as well as his own son. But the facts are not there. Mrs. Gbagbo is not guilty of whatever crimes she is being charged with. This is why I say it is nothing but harassment, pure harassment. We just heard that the representatives of human rights organizations have just pulled out because they don't want to be associated with that masquerade, and they are right.
But why do you suppose the government is insisting on putting Mrs. Gbagbo on trial?
But as I said, this is pure harassment. We are experiencing a very severe dictatorship, never experienced in this country.
Do you think, given what you are saying, that Mrs. Gbagbo will get justice?
No, absolutely not. We are not trying to write fiction. The facts are terrible here in this country under this very severe dictatorship. The trial is definitely and absolutely unfair in the sense that even the judges are under terrible pressure to do everything but being fair according to the law. In criminal law, the facts must be easily verifiable. But Mrs. Gbagbo is not guilty of anything she's charged with. This is pure political harassment. It has nothing to do with whatever is legal. The judges are under constant pressure, and they are not reading the law.
Mrs. Gbagbo is charged with attacking state authority during the post-election crisis. You are saying that is not true.
This is even impossible. Mrs. Gbagbo is an MP. She is a civilian. How can she do military job? She is not qualified even as a civil servant. She is not an official of the government, let alone a military ruler. Imagine just to harass people. Her husband is being harassed in The Hague, herself here, and their son also. This is dictatorship.
Do you and other supporters of Mrs. Gbagbo plan to be at the court?
Yes, we're going to be there to support her and to show that she is not alone and that we understand her struggle and that we are her partners in the quest of freedom and in the quest of the truth.
Boubacar Kone is interim spokesman for the Ivorian Popular Front Party of former President Laurent Gbagbo. He was speaking with me from Abidjan. A court in Senegal on Monday found former Chadian President Issa Habre guilty of crimes against humanity, war crimes, and torture, and sentenced him to life in prison. Rights groups are hailing the landmark verdict as a strong warning to leaders who brutalize their own citizens. VOA's Anne Locke has the story from Dakar with reporting by Alpha Jallo.
Guilty. That was the verdict announced by head judge Gilberto Gustave Kam of Burkina Faso.
Le verdict. Issa Habre. La chambre vous déclare coupable.
The court found Habre to have been directly involved in ordering detentions, executions, systematic torture, and other abuses against people identified as opponents of his regime. Judge Kam said Habre presided over 8 years of uninterrupted repression. Rights groups say Habre was responsible for over 40,000 killings.
En application de l'article 10.2.
During sentencing, Judge Kam said Habre created and maintained a system where impunity and terror were law. He was at the head of a regime of generalized suspicion, so paranoid, the judge said, that Habre himself turned against his own agents. Victims of Habre's regime and relatives of victims in the courtroom Monday wept and cheered after Habre was sentenced to life in prison. It is by the grace of God that we won, said one woman. Her husband, a civil servant under Habre, was detained and tortured. He died before the trial.
Merci à Dieu. Merci à Dieu. Vraiment, les mots.
She says, I cannot find the words. I am very moved. A lion, a man who took himself for God on the earth, has been brought down. Habre said nothing. He joined his hands in a fist and waved at supporters as he was escorted from the court. Habre had refused to stand or acknowledge the judge throughout the trial. His eyes hidden behind sunglasses, his head and face wrapped in a white scarf. He had to be forcibly brought into the court last June when the trial began. He and his lawyers refused to participate, and the trial was briefly suspended while court-appointed attorneys prepared his defense. Habre fled to Senegal in 1990 after he was ousted in a coup. The case against him has been over 20 years in the making. The Extraordinary African Chambers is an African Union tribunal created in 2013 within Senegal's justice system and funded by the international community. Over 4,500 victims were registered as civil parties in the case. Chadian lawyer Jacqueline Mudena is lead counsel for the victims. She says today marks the end of the victims' relentless search for justice. She says it's a great joy for the victims and for Africa, because we are sending a strong message to tyrants all over the world. Among those who testified were 69 survivors of detention and abuses, including a woman Habre was found guilty of raping 4 times. Habre's lawyers have 15 days to appeal the verdict. And look for VOA News, Dakar.
Ugandan police have asked the Kampala City Authority to cancel tomorrow's swearing-in ceremony of all elected Kampala leaders, including Lord Mayor Erias Lukwago. This is the second time the ceremony is being postponed. This time, the police say they are canceling the ceremony because of the visits to Uganda of the leaders of South Korea and Turkey, and also because of celebrations marking Uganda's Martyrs' Day on June the 3rd. But Lord Mayor Erias Lukwago, who is a supporter of jail opposition leader Chisa Besigye, says the authorities are up to something sinister.
The country woke up to that surprising news when the spokesperson of the police stunned the nation by that proclamation that there have been no swearing, you know, on Wednesday. It's rather disturbing because the police have just allocated themselves those powers. They don't have the mandate to do that. The functions and obligations of the police do not include powers to issue such orders. But they have gone ahead to do so, which is very, very disturbing. All they are saying is that we are going to host very important guests. There is a visiting president from Turkey and Israel, and that they do not have enough manpower, secure and man all these functions.
The Lord Mayor Lukwago, this will be the second time that your swearing-in ceremony has been canceled or postponed. What do you make of this?
There are some elements within government, including the president himself, who have been sabotaging this function. You know, we won this election against all odds. We have encountered quite a lot of stumbling blocks along the way. Basically, the bottom line here is that the sitting government is not at all interested in having elected leadership in Kampala taking charge of the state affairs. So what explanation, what possible explanation do they have to keep on postponing the swearing-in ceremony for the leadership of the capital city, the gateway to the country? Certainly they are up to a mischief. They are up to something sinister.
Police spokesman Fred Enega says that the swearing-in that was scheduled for June 1st, that you will likely be traveling with a lot of supporters who might disrupt transport system in the city.
That is not true at all, because I've not anywhere indicated that I intend to carry out a procession in Kampala. Neither have I called several people to accompany me on this very important occasion.
This is a similar thing that happened to Dr. Chisa Besigye. Do you feel the police or the government have classified you and Dr. Besigye as one, and therefore they're trying to stop you from doing this?
Yes, to a certain extent, that could be true, because the way they have structured the whole state is that they are targeting particular individuals. They are certain people they have considered to be outlaws. Dr. Besigye, who is now incarcerated in Zira prison, myself and a couple of others, we are being perceived as criminals, as enemies of the state. If much as I won the election, I'm considered to be as an enemy of the state, which is very, very unfortunate. And now they have institutionalized the police state, actually. And this is basically what is happening.
Erias Lukwago is the Lord Mayor of Kampala City. You are speaking with me from Kampala, Uganda. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 31st. Daybreak Africa time is 17 minutes past the hour. In Zimbabwe, the family of missing political activist Itaya Zamora has for the first time released an image said to be that of the missing Occupy Africa Unity Square leader. Reporter Erwin Chifera has details from Harare.
Family representative and Itai's brother, Patson Zamora, told journalists that the image and details and names of his alleged abductors were veiled by some of the people close to his disappearance. Though he could not say whether his brother was dead or alive, Patson said the family sought help from experts to verify the authenticity of the photos. He said the experts noted that they were real. Though the family had previously cited state security agents as responsible for Itai's disappearance, Patson said evidence availed to them pointed to some military intelligence operatives as his possible assailants.
I cannot at this juncture state my brother's fate in the hands of these gangsters, but I can categorically inform you that Itai Zamora was abducted by the military intelligence under the direct instruction and supervision of ZANU-PF.
There was no immediate reaction from the military intelligence over these allegations. Patson, who was flanked by members of Itai's Occupy Africa Unit Square group, showed journalists a purported image of Itai at one of the places where he was kept following his abduction in March last year.
And so this is one of the places where Itai was kept. We managed to verify the image. As a family, we know him. And we also used professional services insofar as identifying the person in the image is concerned.
He said the pictures were provided after they asked for proof of life, but he could not tell when and whether Itai was alive.
We do not know why his head is covered like this or why his head was covered like this, but according to the professionals, there is a highly likelihood that they actually tortured him to such an extent that he sustained injuries, head injuries. And because of that, they had to cover the head.
Zimbabwe Republic Police National Spokesperson, Senior Assistant Commissioner Charity Charamba, refused to comment about the Zamora family press conference, saying she had not seen the purported Itai images. She said the Zamora family was better positioned to provide more information regarding Itai Zamora. Despite a court ruling compelling security agents to find Itai Zamora, the family accuses the police of showing lack of interest in the matter. Zamora, a journalist turned human rights activist, was allegedly abducted by suspected state security agents in March last year. Reporting from Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
China blocked a much-anticipated United Nations resolution to curb lead in paint during last-ditch negotiations at the UN Environment Assembly. But other countries are already moving ahead to change laws for lead paint, which can lead to brain damage in children. Amy Lee has more from Nairobi.
The campaign to phase out lead in paint in developing countries was high on the agenda at the UN Environmental Assembly, known as the Global Parliament of the Environment. But China was the only country to reject a proposal to encourage governments to adopt anti-lead paint laws. As a result, a broad UN resolution to limit chemicals and waste worldwide contained no reference to lead paint. Lead exposure can lead to permanent brain damage in young children if paint chips are eaten or paint dust is inhaled. Alan Meso is with the Environmental Law Division of the UN Environment Program in Nairobi.
Unless we do something now, then we are exposing our children to serious danger.
The United States limits lead in paint to no more than 90 parts per million. But tests in the developing world found lead levels of 10,000 to 100,000 parts per million in decorative paint used in homes, schools, hospitals, and other buildings. Lead exposure leads to lower IQ and decreases in lifetime earning potential. Decreased IQ in children due to lead poisoning represents a $977 billion economic loss in developing countries, according to a report from New York University's medical school released during the UN Assembly. Excluding lead and paint from the UN resolution is a disappointing blow for policymakers. However, many developing countries are drafting their own regulations on lead paint as part of the Global Alliance to End Lead Paint by 2020. With support from the alliance, Sri Lanka, Philippines, Nepal, and Thailand have enacted new laws limiting lead in paint. India and Bangladesh are finalizing draft regulations. This is Sarah Boucher, manager for IPEN's Global Lead Paint Elimination Campaign.
Things have moved really, really fast. And one of the main reasons for that is that stakeholders work together. So industry, when they got aware about the situation, they wanted to move on this as well as policymaker and civil society. So it's a very good and encouraging example of all stakeholders working together to move this issue forward in these countries.
15 African countries, including Kenya and Ethiopia, are already forming new regulations expected to be finalized this year. Meso of UNEP attended a meeting of African partners in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, in December. He says,
it's not about attacking industry. It's about saving the future of our children. So bring them on board is critical. So I don't think the deadline of 2020 is beyond reach. It is achievable. It is achievable. We just need political will and we'll push it through.
Lack of awareness about the health threats of lead paint is a major hurdle. Lack of expertise in testing as well as regulating informal paint makers are also challenges. But advocates say substituting lead in paint with safe alternatives is relatively simple and inexpensive. Amy Yee, VOA News in Nairobi.
In just 13 years, Nollywood, Nigeria's film industry, has grown from zero into a $250 million a year industry that employs thousands of people. The success of Nollywood is mostly credited to the originality of the storylines. Abimbola Bode Olaoba met with Kunle Afolayan, one of the top three film producers of Nigeria, who highlights the success and impact of the industry on the African continent.
Nollywood, through the initial use of video technology and now affordable digital technology, produces more than 2,000 films per year. The Nigerian film industry's popularity has spread across the African continent to the African diaspora, mostly in Europe, North America, and Australia.
Our great nation, Nigeria, will be independent in 2 weeks.
Afolayan is one of Nigeria's prolific filmmakers, is one of the few who has been able to propel African films into cinemas. Clear has been able to draw the Nigerian audience by creating films that are worthy of the African cinema and the international market at large. He admits that the success of Nigeria's film industry is based on the ability to tell stories that reflect Nigerian culture.
We tell our own stories, you know, regardless of whether the quality is top-notch, whether it's the quality is so great. No, for us, it's more about the stories. And that is what has given an average Nollywood that reach, you know, to spread out. Because they don't wait for big budgets. They just have an idea of a story and they tell their stories.
Koi admits that Nollywood has had a great impact on Africa as a whole, especially for its audiences who have been fed imported content.
Well, it's very true, because a lot of, if you go to all those African countries now, especially in Kenya, you know, Nairobi, for example, once they see your passport and they realize you're in Nigeria, they say, Igwe, you know, they say all those, you know, languages and terms they hear in our film. So we've influenced them, you know, a great deal. The same thing in South Africa, the same thing in Malawi. And this we should use to our advantage, because it simply means we're all out there and we just need to keep upgrading.
Nollywood has positioned itself as a practical information, distribution, an image-making tool in Africa, though the industry still has its challenges. Colette believes the right platform for distribution is vital for the progress of the industry.
Once you have the platform to recoup your investment back, that will encourage people to want to put more capital, invest more in production value, because that is the major thing that most of our films lack. If all of that is to an extent fixed, then I believe it will be bigger than Hollywood.
Abimbola Bode Olaoba for Voice of America.
Time now for Daybreak Africa's Post. Here is Margo Omar in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Zambia held their hosts Gambia to a scoreless draw in Baku on Monday. Meanwhile, Kenya hosts Sudan in a friendly in Nairobi today, Tuesday. In rugby, Mali required two extra time sessions to subdue hosts Togo 17-12 and win the West Africa Rugby Sevens tournament in Lome on Saturday. Ghana outwitted Niger 14-5 to claim the bronze medal, while Benin outclassed Burkina Faso 22-5 in the fifth place playoff. In France, Kenya beat Japan 12-5 in the 11th place playoff at the IRB Women's Sevens tournament in Paris. Kenya is the only African team to play in the series this year. Turning to athletics, Dino Serafir clocked 2 hours, 8 minutes and 14 seconds to lead Shura Kitata in an Ethiopian 1-2 win at the Ottawa Marathon in Canada on Sunday. Kenya's Dominic Ondoro placed third, while Koren Jelela ran 2 hours, 27 minutes and 6 seconds to lead defending champion Aberu Mekuria and Sechale Dalasa in a 1-2-3 Ethiopian medal podium sweep. Staying in Ottawa, Kenya's world half-marathon champion Peres Jepchirchir clocked 31 minutes and 29 seconds to triumph in the women's contest at the Ottawa 10-kilometer race. Ethiopian Mamitu Daska was runner-up ahead of Kenyan Rebecca Chesire. Meanwhile, Morocco's Mohamed Ziani pipped Ethiopian Yitayal Zerihun to win the men's race. Both were credited with an identical time of 28 minutes and 37 seconds, while Morocco's Ahmed Tamri was placed third in 28 minutes and 40 seconds. Elsewhere, Kenya's Boaz Kiprono and Eda Jepkosgei were crowned men's and women's champions respectively at the Edinburgh Marathon in Scotland on Sunday. Meanwhile, a 16-year-old new find, Jacob Kiplimo, looked set to be the youngest athlete on the Uganda Olympic team. Kiplimo made his mark when he won the 5,000 meters in 13 minutes and 24.40 seconds in Orvieto, Italy. The Olympic qualifying standard is 13 minutes and 25 seconds. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And that's it for this Tuesday, May 31st edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ouma, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very, very good day.
Hi, I'm Susan Yawkey of VOA's International Edition. VOA's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of some of the world's greatest experts on international issues. But you don't have to tune in at broadcast time. Listen when you want. Just go to voanews.com. Click the Programs tab and scroll down to International Edition.
Music time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.